Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of Food of Thought. Today, before we start, we're going to send it over to Ben for our current competition that's going on for our giveaway.
Yes, so we've got a giveaway over. We're hosting alongside a company called Niche. They make the most amazing home grinders and they're being given away. We're also giving away some coffee, courtesy of a company called Just Brew. Then we're also giving away a dripper and a whole load of custom equipment from Skate Create Reclaim or Skate Reclaim Create. I always get it mixed up. Also a pour over kettle as well. So if you want to win that, it's on Niche's page and it's available until the 19th of June.
Perfect. Literally the best thing ever. A full setup that's just ready for you just brew coffee. So convenient. All right.
And
it's free. Yeah. All you have to do is just enter your name, tag your friend, follow the order's account, you get a free. Pardon?
We even pay for the postage.
Yeah, exactly. What more can you ask for? But yep, that's a giveaway. And I'm joined today with an incredible person. He's really knowledgeable around coffee roasting and looking forward to dive into it. Let's introduce us, Marcus Wood. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hey guys. So my name, I'm Marcus Wood. I am the head roaster at Kiss the Hippo. I've been in coffee for about 10 years. I've been roasting for about 5 years now. I've started off in as a barista. I started working in I watched your video with Will from Kima, and I am also a supermarket barista graduate. So I started working in a supermarket. I was in Sainsbury's as a barista there for 3 years before moving to London to start studying, where I continued working as a barista before I found myself working as a roaster. That's been me for the last few years now.
Amazing. Do you start roasting coffee at Redemption then?
No, I actually started, there's a cafe roastery in Ealing in West London called Cafe Z. And I was working there whilst I was studying for my degree. I started working there part-time just as a barista just help with bills and whatever. But they were roasting at the back of the room, so they only roasted for themselves. It was a 6 kilo Giessen roaster. We only had one cafe at the time. It was a really small operation. It was literally I think our cafe did about 20 kilos a week.
Awesome.
So we were, just doing it for ourselves and just exploring our own coffees. But it wasn't necessary. It was definitely specialty coffee, but it wasn't, we didn't do filter coffee, for example. It was purely espresso. It was basically what could we pair with a Brazilian this month, I was there working as a barista for about a year before my manager, who was the roaster, left. And at the time it was an interesting time because they were opening up a new shop and they were diversifying the company in different ways. They wanted to take the company wholesale, which we managed very on a really small scale. But it was like a little window for me to get into roasting. So I would kind of do my open morning shift. I'd start at 7 a.m. or 6 a.m. rather, and finish. I would soak up all the roasting knowledge from the owner of the company, to the point where I would just become their kind of like part-time roaster, and then it transcended into a full-time job before I was approached by Redemption Roasters. So yeah, kind of like, you know, just took some steps. I was probably roasting for about a year before I met Redemption. Kind of cascaded that way. So
because that's just me, like me in the same position as you now, like putting that perspective before you move to Redemption. I'm roasting at Boston Roastery for a year now, and I'm just like, do I know enough? Or do you feel like you know enough at that time to actually move?
No. I don't know. I had very limited access to resources at the time, but I was using I don't know, probably, I was probably putting in about not even 50% of the work you put in, like, at the moment. I was reading up on any coffee book I can get my hands on and any roasting information on Reddit or, you know, anywhere on Instagram or something. I don't know, it was, because I was studying, my degree at the time, it was very much a part-time kind of interest that just kind of, it kind of changed my interest from my degree was in music and film. I realized I was spending less time creating music and creating videos and more time learning about roasting and then actually roasting. I've never felt, well, like when I was approached by Redemption to work as their head roaster, I come thinking like, I don't know what I'm doing, like, really. I think the more you work in the industry, specifically in wholesale roasting, I find, you become exposed to so many different areas of the industry. When I was at Redemption, I went from not being in the buying position to being a green buyer as well.
Yeah.
Like that opened me up to a whole new element of the industry. But you're just constantly learning. So.
That's amazing. That is amazing. Because I do like love when people are integrating different area into your role as well. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, sure. I mean, when I started at Redemption, the job I applied for was actually there. It was like a production assistant. This was like back when Redemption used to operate in Aylesbury Prison. And it was a really small operation. I think when I joined, they're only doing about 100 kilos a week. Mm. Compared to what they're doing now, that's like a really small percentage of their wholesale kind of output. We were doing a really, really small amount. There was already a head of coffee, there was already a head roaster, and our cohort was completely different when I joined to the cohort that we kind of left with. It was a completely different operation, but I quickly took on the role of head roaster after the head roaster left. And then once the head of coffee left, I kind of naturally fell into that position because they needed someone to do the coffee buying. Everything just kind of added up. So
Ben, any questions?
No, I'm just here listening. I think it's really cool hearing about your coffee journey. Obviously now we know you as Marcus from Kiss the Hippo.
Yeah.
how did you come into that?
It's a good question. I met Josh Tarlow in 2019, and I live in Twickenham, right? Twickenham's right next to Richmond. Richmond is the only specialty, it's the only roastery in like West London, Southwest London, that has obviously exceeds expectations, release after release. So I was fortunate enough to be in walking distance from probably one of the best roasteries in the UK. I can remember going in there every time. The first time I went in there, as you guys know, Rodolfo.
I know Rodolfo.
Yeah.
So when I the first time I went in there, I just got the warmest welcome from Rodolfo. You know what his mannerisms like. He's incredibly polite. He's incredibly charming.
Charming, yeah.
He's a great guy. And he made me the most amazing pour over from Germina. I thought this is like next level. This isn't just great coffee, this is a great experience. That was kind of like my instruction. I was like, this is the standards that Kiss the Hippo set with their coffee, with their barista kind of customer interaction. I just had this like weird attachment to Kiss the Hippo. I was there like pretty much every weekend. And then eventually I got in touch with Josh, and I went along for a coffee with him. We were chatting everything from green coffee buying to their rare and acclaimed sourcing and the way that they go about. I mean, how can you choose between 5-92 scoring coffees on a table? Like I just needed to know how does he make that decision, because I've never been before then. I'd never been at a table where there's 5-92 or 93 scoring coffees. I've never seen that.
I never haven't.
Even now, like sometimes I'm cupping coffee, so I'm just like, who am I to be cupping a Geshe like every day kind of thing? Like I feel so above me, but
yeah.
It was an amazing experience. And then Josh and I just got chatting, and then I think we had a lot in common with our sourcing kind of philosophy and our roasting philosophy. And it just so happened at the time that Rosa, the last head roaster, was moving on to Pastors New. So yeah. it happened quite naturally that I was looking for new opportunities and new challenges, and Rosa was leaving her position. So it just kind of, it felt quite naturally.
So fortunate. And but you also got the skill to live up to it. So, you know, it's all worked out really well.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that is credit to, Valoring is an incredible roasting machine. It blew my mind. When I was leaving Redemption, we were deciding which roaster were they going to put in the new roastery in the Mount. And I'd already made up my mind that I was going to be leaving the company, I was just absolutely praying that they were going to go for the Loring instead of what the other ones that they were approached by, because I was just like, you know, it's an exceptional machine. It's just incredible the amount of consistency you can get.
That's the thing, isn't it? You strive for as a roastery, same experience for customer.
Yeah, exactly.
You just keep coming back to the same.
No, you're totally right. And you know, it's definitely something that I mean, I know, but you know, when you find a really memorable coffee, you want to experience that time and time again.
Yeah.
And it's as much as me putting a roaster and doing my QC and getting to enjoy that every single week. But knowing that that's going out to so many hundreds of customers every week, it is an incredible kind of, you know, I'm just glad that I get to share that coffee and that story with so many people, and I know that it's going to be enjoyed. So,
you know, like, sorry, Marcus, but like before, when I'd never met you before, so I thought that you came out of like the prison.
Well,
I was just like, you just fall into the, you know, roasting world and just like come out of Redemption.
No, it's totally understandable. I mean, I had that misunderstanding. Every time when I was working Redemption, we'd have like special guests come around.
Yeah.
I was, everyone would be like, you know, so are you there? I'm like, no, I'm not, but you know, I'm glad you asked first before assuming. But no, it was funny actually. We had, do you know Newground?
Newground, yes.
Yeah. So obviously, they specialize working with ex-offenders, and that's like part of their whole mission. When I was first I did a bit like a kind of like an introduction with Newground in 2018, and we realized that they were going to be. I mean, for Redemption, it's like a natural step, right? It's it's so hard to find roasting positions as it is. But to be able to kind of have like almost like an academy, like a step after the Redemption Academy, to move from Redemption into a potential working environment that also does roasting, is like an amazing step. So you like usually, I mean, I still keep in touch with the people that have gone from the prisons to Newground, or people like obviously with Newground themselves. So I tell you, I get a lot of people kind of assume I was also part of the Aylesbury Academy.
That's very cool. Yeah, so moving on to like the first question of today.
Yeah, go for it.
Was, you know, how does COVID-19 affecting UK coffee industry, especially like for you as a roaster?
Yeah. You know,
like process of choosing coffee, for instance.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, we've kind of it's not necessarily gone to pot, right? But you know, we've had ideas of what our wholesale offering and our retail offering could look like over the course of the year. So, you know, when I was, I definitely assist with the choosing of coffee, but at the end of the day, this is Josh's kind of catalog. So, you know, when we have like an initial idea of how long coffee is going to run on for, we're looking at, you know, current sales projections, and you know, where at what point do we think we actually might run out of this coffee, so let's get replaced in the Soup Exceptional and fill its place afterwards. So we definitely saw that we were expecting some of our coffees to have fallen off by now. and to have already been replaced. But I think from an end user perspective, from us as the roasters buying coffee from either traders or from farmers directly, it's kind of put a bit of a spanner in the works. But ultimately, you know, the way that we are able to purchase coffee on such a consistently regular basis from UK warehouses or from European warehouses, you know, we're quite lucky in the sense that we are still able to keep our current reserves up the stock.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're still able to commit to the coffees we bought. Luckily, we've not had to say to anyone, I'm sorry, we can't buy this coffee anymore because we don't have a place for it. Or so from that end, it's definitely quite good. But like, I think from like our George Street blend, for example, you know, we've got two cafes that consistently go through nearly 60 kilos a week.
Crazy.
And, you know, to have had that kind of pause on things has been, I think, a bit of a wake up call. Like, you know, from a buying perspective, things need to be more sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if something like a pandemic can really, you know, not necessarily destroy the coffee process, the buying process, but actually really kind of like it gets to the point where it's going to affect the aging of green coffee.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the sort, like the way that we currently have a sourcing model, how is that going to be affected, you know, in the future? Like, we just need to be a bit more on our toes. And I think, I mean, this caught everyone off guard, right? So I think to begin with, we were all quite shook, but now I think we've come to a really comfortable point. Since this all started. So
one of the questions that I actually put to Paul actually a couple of weeks ago when I did a live with him was, how do you see the process of cupping protocol change as a result of COVID-19?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting one. I've always kind of thought cupping's a bit gross. Like the way that everyone, I mean, I'm a little bit of a germaphobe. So the fact that everyone has previously, you know, shared a bowl and like everything has been not necessarily unhygienic, but there could definitely be more ways to make it more hygienic. I'm kind of glad that things have changed. We were doing our QC, so we've got two baristas that we've kind of taken on to work in the production space to assist with our current production levels. So quite recently we've been going through routinely QCing our coffee with them so they can get to the point where they are up to scratch with laying out a QC project and going through it you know, by themselves, so that, you know, that they're able to experience QCing. Possibly for the first time. I'm not too sure if either of them have worked in roasting before. I'm quite enjoying having my own bowl to cup from, as an example, or cupping. I find the whole process is actually it allows me to focus more on what I'm cupping, and to really give more time to assess the actual procedure itself. There's always like this element I've found, especially when I first got into coffee and was specifically assessing or grading coffee. There's always like, especially when you're like around a table of, let's say, 30 people, you're all trying to race to get to that last part of the natural Ethiopian or something like that.
Yeah.
There's always like this, there's almost like a time pressure of trying to get to that, cup. I feel like it could potentially, could have like a negative effect on how you evaluate coffee. But now that, you know, the procedure itself has changed, I feel like you're able to really focus on what you're tasting. So I think it's probably going to improve coffee evaluation, personally. But, yeah.
So there's a couple of ways that people have suggested doing like the mass cupping.
Yeah.
Where you invite people. I know I've done actually a couple with Kiss a Hippo.
At
Fitzrovia. We did one in January. And one thing that someone suggested was having like small cups and then spooning out of the cups and slurping from those. Someone else, I think it was actually you, Nat, that suggested brewing French press and then like which option for mass cuppings do you see as being like the most easily approachable? For obviously you can't have 300 cupping bowls if you've got 10 beers for
Yeah.
I think French press is more like you can buy a big French press and brew it to protocol of brewing a French press. And then, you know, you can still taste. And plus, people are seeing French press go, actually, I can do this at home. So why not get loads of coffee and have two or three French press on the go? And you can cup literally for even longer, actually, you know, because it's heat mass.
Like, thermal mass, yeah.
Yeah, thermal mass, so.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think from a QC perspective, the way that I've always preferred to evaluate my coffee is actually how do I brew it? So whenever I drop a roast out, the first thing I do is I brew a filter, because that's like my first indication as to, you know, what is this coffee going to taste like? Is this going to taste on par, because this is how the customers are going to experience it? But yeah, I think from like a general like public cupping perspective, I totally agree. I mean, like, yeah, I think the French press idea could possibly be a way forward. I think the only thing you'd have to kind of, I guess, consider would be when you're usually cupping, the sediments and the coffee kind of stay with each other,
yeah,
as opposed to the French press where you would discard the sediments. Sorry, you discard the coffee from the sediment. So there would be a change in how the coffee tastes as it cools down. But
yeah, it's all interesting, all really interesting. Let's see where it takes.
And talking about like brewing it as you would brew it at home, being like a method of QC, this kind of actually links back to another topic that I wanted to involve, but for a different way. So when you may remember, went to visit James Hoffman to do our podcast with him. You had an interesting experiment going on at the same time. And I remember this one. And I figured out who it was because of the recipe that you'd used. it's the Kiss the Hippo recipe, and I know it. So.
the experiment itself is, I mean, it's like an ongoing thing that I'm doing on a weekly basis. So we've had as many negative experiences as we've had positive. So there's still a lot of room for maneuver. Interestingly, like for example, last weekend I was trying a new approach to the whole idea of fermentation, the resulting coffee was incredibly savory. It was incredibly savory to the point where it's like, this kind of tastes like broth. But then when we kind of brewed it with a bypass method, just by adding way more water after the initial kind of couple of pours, using the same coffee, it's using the same amount of water that we were going to pour through the coffee anyway. It was incredibly sweet and floral. So right now, what I'm experiencing with this experiment is that I'm just collecting as much data as I possibly can. Just getting to a point where I can start to like share the time. I mean, like I sent you some of the the Shirley,
it was surprisingly like champagne, like exactly as you described it. And I was expecting it to be as you'd said, and then when it was, I was still sort of surprised. It didn't really taste as I'd expect it to come across. It was still like super light, and then there was this big hit of body, and then it was thin, and then there was a bit of dryness, and then it kind of came back at the end, and
yeah,
all this weird different stages. And it's just this this very new, I would describe as new process of like it's new ground, it's territory that's not really been anyone yet.
Yeah, and this is the element that we are kind of facing right now, is that because the processing element of this is so different, then does this mean the roasting approach needs to be different? Does this mean the brewing approach needs to be different? And because I've had so many mixed results, it's what I'm trying to do now is find a level ground where I can start from. I've been working on this kind of idea since I bought coffee from Uganda, because we we bought three or four bags of a really experimental fermentation. And it was quite funny because when I was talking to the former head of wholesale and the farmer himself, rather the producer I should say, he was kind of like, you know, it's really experimental. So, you know, what we wanted to do is to evaluate it, and then we'll tell you about the process. And he was fermenting the coffee with cascara as the source of sugar, which was like a really cool kind of, I mean, it wasn't so experimental in the sense that a lot of people do that anyway. But it was experimental to him, and it was something that they haven't done before. I mean, you don't necessarily see too much fermented coffee coming from Uganda. So it was a really interesting approach that they had taken. But the thing that had kind of resonated really well with me was the idea that when we did this, when we brought all the coffees through, and I was assessing the moisture content on the fermented coffee was way higher than the moisture content on the other coffees. Mm. I say way higher, it was like 2% higher, but you know, a jump from every coffee being like a steady 12% to this fermented coffee being at 14% got me thinking about like moisture content and my kind of own understanding of like the content of moisture in things like seeds and nuts. And I do a lot of like sprouting, like grains and stuff at home. It kind of got me thinking about the idea of what if you sprout coffee? Like, what if I was just trying to sprout coffee and then roast it? Like, what would that do? That's kind of where the idea stemmed from. And then it's kind of cascaded into this, how many weird things can I do to this coffee as it ages and still increase its cut score? So it's kind of moving in that direction, and yeah, we'll see. I mean, I'm doing more experiments as we go along. I'm trying to get to the point where I can do it on a mass basis. When I say mass, it's like 5 kilos or something. At the moment, I'm doing it like 100 grams at a time, and I'm having to roast it in a pan, like a stovetop roaster. I made the mistake of doing that the other day whilst I was cooking, and I was absolutely boiling at the end. Like a roasting oven in front of me, and I was on top of the hob, and I was just like wiping sweat. it's really uncharted territory. Right now it's just a case of collecting.
Have you found like any repeatability with it? Like if you do one, then you do it the next time, it will be like similar results.
Yeah, so that the one that I sent you actually was my third attempt at doing this. And it's gone to the point where, I mean, like I said, I'm using a stovetop roaster only because since lockdown, Josh has had the Akawa. So I'll wipe the dust off the stovetop roaster again and give that a bash. But I was collecting, it wasn't the first time I did it, I recorded every single different change I made. I made little markings on the gas hob as to like where, like at what point in the roast did I change it. And the first one was the first one I tried was, I think I had a brighter acidity to the second two.
Yeah.
But it fell flat really quickly. So I changed the roast style in the next one to get a far longer development. And then I did the same thing, I repeated the same one, the third one, which is the one I sent you. And realized that actually I'd given it the same score twice in a row. I picked a very, very similar on the second one. I think the first one was actually quite had more like a creamy mouthfeel as opposed to like a dry white wine. The second and third one, both of them tasted like dry white wine. And the idea behind like the benefit I saw when I received those kind of taste notes, I thought this is a really memorable coffee. Like this is something that I won't necessarily forget. It's not a session coffee. I can't drink this all day, but this is something that is like, it is like a really interesting coffee.
It's an experience coffee almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a really, at least, you know, if it can't be done on a mass basis, it can at least be an experience coffee. So.
Yeah. It's like, it's opening, like back to the moisture content that we were talking about. It's quite interesting because it's opened so much possibilities, because it's not necessarily the moisture that's been increasing over time. It's the moisture that can increase in one go.
And yeah.
When you were roasting it, I was kind of asking wrong question, really. It was like, was that help with the roast to extend? But you said it's more help with the development.
With regards to the moisture content, or
yeah, regarding moisture content.
Yeah, I mean, what I found, and it's quite funny because I was talking to a few people that I've worked with in the past, and a few people in the food industry who work specifically with like baking, mm-hmm. And what I learned really quickly was a high moisture content doesn't necessarily mean like a slower roast. It doesn't mean that it requires more time. It actually means that the additional moisture gives you more, like there's basically more transfer of heat. Like moisture is a fantastic conductor of heat. And what this does, I don't know, did you ever get to try Dan O'Regan's coffee that he used in the UKBC this year?
No, I didn't get a chance to.
No, I didn't.
Okay, so it was a like a rehydrated Sudan room, and it was bizarre. I mean, like whenever you look at like rehydrated coffee when it's in roasted, it doesn't look like regularly roasted coffee. Like it does, it looks completely different. It kind of looks a bit scary. You kind of think it looks really uneven. But that's just like, it's like black tea. Like when you ferment black tea, it's incredibly black. And you know, you compare that to like green tea or white tea or something like that. You know, you're going to get those kind of like strong, like what you the kind of taste notes you would associate with an over extraction are the taste notes that are, you know, possibly more prevalent. But yeah, the actual, you know, it's like, I don't know, I guess it's like a misunderstanding of what the coffee is actually going to taste like. So, yeah. But yeah, the roasting wise, it's actually a far quicker roast, which gives you, I think, I mean, from my own experience, it's given me more of an opportunity to really assess at what point am I able, like first crack happens violently. It is like a proper cascade of it's like a, you know, proper symphony of sound. It's incredible, really. Yeah, when you've got that, it's time to really start focusing on your development process, because like, you haven't got long.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Any other question, Ben?
No.
Oh, the question I was going to ask was, you know, with all these, like, you know, I'm sure that you experienced the same. Online order have been increased.
Mm.
It's the Hippo. Same with Box and Roastery. You feel like there's a demand for much more of like omni roast for your coffee?
Yeah, I mean, the amazing thing we've noticed, and I've personally experienced this from my own entry to coffee, is that, you know, you know where everybody starts with coffee is, you know, in the cafe scene, really. Or it is usually at home with French press, and then you move into the cafe scene, you get addicted to latte and flat white.
Yeah,
and then eventually you kind of move back into the filter option and realizing that actually it was like I had an espresso the other day. So I had the Indian coffee from Newgrounds the other day, and I would drink filter all day. I'll probably have one espresso in the morning and then filter all day, but I could not get enough of that Indian as a filter and as an espresso. And we're seeing the same thing with our customers. You know, we've got our Shirley Natural Rwandan, which is a fantastic, it really is a fantastic filter. And we're seeing more and more customers using it as, you know, asking for both brewing recipes. You know, how would you brew this as an espresso? How would you brew this as a filter coffee? And I think that's a really inviting and, really exciting as well, development that I've seen. I think what home brewing has offered people is whatever they can afford within their own personal budget,
yeah,
they're going to use your coffee regardless. And so you get to see like more of a broader scale of the usage in your coffee and how people are deciding to use it. And so, you know, in our cafes, we've got one blend and one single origin on a, you know, in our hoppers. But, you know, if we've only got, let's say, our own Peruvian or our George Street on in our hoppers, what's to stop a customer buying, you know, some of our Gesher or some of our Sholi or Los Naranjos and putting that in their espresso machine? Yeah. So I'm finding home baristas' own experiments with our coffees to be an incredibly exciting movement, because I think it's opening up the conversation once more. And I think the more we talk about, you know, how omni roasting is like a super beneficial way to enjoy your coffee. It doesn't restrict you to one brewing option.
Mm.
And it kind of disregards a lot of false information that's been out there, you know. And you know, a light roast is only suitable for filter, or a dark roast is only suitable for espresso. Those ideas are very kind of exclusive. Mm. But I'm finding that
really effective too, because it's not,
yeah.
Yeah. It's not like,
yeah.
Some people like roast on their espresso.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, no, exactly. And I think this is exactly what we're seeing as well. Is, you know, we are seeing customers being more and more engaged with their own brewing methods. And I think when you're in a cafe kind of scene, like you're the information you're going to get about brewing coffee is specifically going to come from your barista. So if you're buying a coffee in any cafe and you ask them, how would you brew this at home, or how would you recommend I grind this for this particular coffee, that the barista you talk to is your source of information, and that's like the one that you're, because I feel like there's a direct correlation between people buying coffee from a cafe and then doing exactly what the barista says, and then possibly not necessarily buying the same coffee again because they weren't too happy with it, but giving the coffee to a customer with not necessarily no information, but like a clean slate, just like, you know, this, you know, enjoy your coffee. Mm, yeah. Like giving them the option to discover how they can best enjoy it, I think it's been incredibly helpful for our own customers' understanding of coffee, and you know, I think it's going to do really good things going forward. I think it's going to really open up the conversation. I actually can't wait for the cafe scene to become buzzing again, because I really want to see some customers, man. You know.
Well, going back to that point on customers creating their own experience, is that what people realize in the industry and around it is that no two machines will be the same. Two grinders will be the same. They're going to have different calibrations and they'll perform better at different recipes and also different waters. There's so many variables that it's almost useless to give an exact recipe. To give it something for context is my shop Hoxton in Winchester, we sell coffee from a company called River, and I almost always tell people to start at what they brew most commonly. So if they're brewing their filter recipe and they come and buy River for the first time and they say, how would you brew this? I'm like, no, how would you brew this? And start from there, because otherwise I'm going to tell you how I brew it, and it's not going to be the same experience for you at home. And while I'm on the subject, one really interesting, movement, experiment idea, came from Sage, the brewers from Sage Brewers. And they suggested that no one's really taken them up on this option yet of, you have this this brewer that can profile how someone makes it at home. And theoretically, if you have the same two waters and the same two grinds, that one person in site A and site B will be able to have the same experience. And so they were saying if there were roasters that were taking up that opportunity of saying, look, here's our profiles for this, this, and this. Here's what we used. Here's the grind setting we had. Here's our dose. This is the program that you can download and plug into your brewer, that people will be able to have direct and comparable brews, which I thought was a really interesting idea. But
no, you're totally right. And I think I don't know if you joined James Hoffman for the biggest cupping that he did. Did you join this last year?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I was part of it as well, and I thought it was just the concept itself of everyone using the same water profile, and the remarkable thing this did is actually put into the forefront the importance of water in espresso. I think it was an incredible experience, and like very direct education for so many people that you can't just use tap water based on, I mean, like, for example, in Casteva, right, we use BWT. So if we're sending coffee to a customer that has an existing relationship with Brita, for example, our water is already different. So we need to, you know, we need to find a way to brew our coffee to the better they can get that coffee at. And it's not saying that BWT is better than Brita, it's not saying that Brita is better than BWT, but it's just saying your water is going to be different, so let's try and find a way to make your coffee taste as good on your side than it does on ours. I think the importance of having like water, like the same water across like all sites. So let's say my water in West London is probably different to the water up in Buxton. It's probably different to the water in Winchester. It's different all over the place. What I'm trying to get at is it's like trying to find the most common ground on a mass basis. I sent my brother for his birthday because I've just started getting into specialty coffee. So I was like, you know, dude, I've got you this water, this kettle, Brita filter kettle. Mm. It filters your water, it boils your water, then you can decant it, kind of control your temperature. Like, it's going to be the best coffee you've ever had, because at the moment he's just drinking tap water, right? He's like, yeah, it's really good. Bit of a faff, but it's all right. And I'm like, bit of a faff is worth it, man. I don't know. I think the idea of the uniform coffee experience is incredibly hard to achieve. I think it's incredibly important. Well, I was gonna say, I'm not suggesting that everyone goes out and buys distilled water and then adds, calcium and magnesium to the water to try and get the right amount. But as Nim said, uniform water is pretty important.
So this was a discussion that we sort of had with James off of the air. But I've had it with a number of people since, and one of the mini solutions that may not work but could be worth a trial, and I can think of one place that does this, which is a company called, I always get this wrong, it's South Sea Coffee Co. I always say South Coast Roast, which is not right. South Sea Coffee Co. And they have little connected Brita taps to their customer tap, where people can go and refill their own water glasses at the restaurant, but they're also perfect for brewing water.
Right.
So it's the same water profile that the shop uses, and people could just go in and fill up a 5-liter bottle of water, take it home with them, and use that. And then you kind of kill two birds with one stone in terms of you haven't got this wastage of people going out and buying deionized water. There are other ways of doing this, but you also, at the same time, then have that mirrorable experience between the shop and the customer.
I think that's a great idea. I think James actually mentioned this in one of his videos comparing. I think he was comparing four different water filters. It was Brita, BWT, I think. It might have been that one where he bought something from IKEA or something like that, and Peak, yeah. He did suggest that, a far more environmentally friendly and far more sustainable option might just be to go to your local cafe and ask to use their filtered water. And I do think that could be an option. I think that should start happening. It costs very little for us for a cafe to give away some of their filtered water, and it could be another way to help with the customer front and the customer experience of water. And I think, if I was in a position where, let's say if it was my cafe and I had customers saying, hey, I love the coffee when I'm here, but when I go home, it doesn't taste as sweet, or it doesn't taste as acidic or lively. Do you have to give them, some of your water for them to compare that to then, that would A, assist your own roasting style, like this is your own brewing style, to see if there's ways to get better coffee out there. But it's just, I feel like it's also a more personal approach to the customer, and I feel like that's what is so important in the coffee industry, is that we are, because we're always trying to break down barriers and to educate as much as we can. I think to give people like that kind of opportunity is going to be incredibly key. So I think it's a great idea.
There's other options as well, as far as getting deionized water that doesn't involve the plastic waste of going to Halfords or going to Asda and buying bottles from there. So one that I came across pretty recently, and it was Josh actually from Filtered Thoughts that kind of put me in contact with this method, is there's a company called Spotless Water, and they have lots of 24-hour refill stations around the UK. Now, they're an RO-based way of obtaining water, which isn't the best in terms of the actual water waste, but it I guess destroys the way of ruining the planet. And what it is it's originally actually intended for like cleaning fish tanks or for like rare aquatic animals and things like that where they need specific water.
Okay.
And so for like car wash stations to have streakless options where you've got zero TDS in your water. So you get a nice polish to the car. But no one's really tried it for coffee and brought it to coffee as a mainstream way. And it's actually really cheap as well. It's like 3 pence a litre. And all people that are going out and buying bottled water, this is another option. The water's being boiled, so it's going to kill any bacteria or anything like that, you know. But I'm curious to hear your thoughts on something like that being.
Yeah, I think that's again, I think that's from a sustainability point of view, I think that's a really good opportunity for people to enjoy better water. And I mean, so long as it is definitely like safe and tried and tested, I think there's going to need to be some kind of regulation to ensure that that is safe, just from like a medical perspective. But I think I think that's an amazing way to decrease waste and to increase enjoyment of coffee at home.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, whereabouts are these sites?
They're scattered. So I'm living in Horsham at the moment, and I've actually got one about a mile away from me, which is perfect because I go in the car, I fill up 50 litres at a time, cost me £2.50, and I come back, and 50 litres last me a long time. So
yeah.
On top of that, you also have I know there's one in Southampton from where I live in Winchester as well as the nearest one. But the company's based in Basingstoke, so there's tons and tons of them around the UK. I think there's something like 80 or 90 or something like that. But they're scattered. There's some in London, I think, even. But it's mainly it's a good concentration of car wash areas, because car washes buy like 5,000 litres at a time, so they're a big client for these people.
Yeah, I imagine. That sounds like a fantastic idea. I might have to get some contacts out of you there.
Get a fob as well, it's great. I think as an industry, as we're kind of progressing, I think COVID has kind of given us a platform to almost like really step back and have a think and start again in terms of ideas of trying to fix a wastage issue.
Definitely.
And James he said that he'd been thinking about this problem for a really long time, and for a while there's just no real immediate solutions, but the solution should come and come quickly. One really good one, which is a couple of roasters, I know Curve do this, I know River do this, is to provide like reusable tubs for wholesale clients.
But
obviously you have an issue with clients that are really far away.
I think Perky Blenders do this as well. I think what Perky Blenders do is really fun, really fantastic actually, because they've got local free delivery using electric vans, so they are really going above and beyond to try and keep their own personal carbon emissions as low as possible, and to really show off the real benefits of moving in a sustainable way, and I think that the best way to kind of vocalize it is to do it. I think when the more roasters will start putting their money where their mouths are, will be a really good day for coffee. I think that's a great idea.
Nat, do you have anything to add to that one?
Yes, it was like off of the James Hoffman forum when we were there. He was focusing on like companies goals, and like they have to change the way they look at things and to really survive, basically. Because he was talking about how coffee industry is going to take a dip, like a beer industry does, like 20 years ago.
Mm.
It is something that people should, if they said they're going to do it, they should do it, you know.
Yeah, I think I said it right. I also think from the customer's perspective is what they want. It's easier for the consumer to be put in a position where they've got either no choice or the choice to buy from a sustainable model and to leave it up to the consumer to not buy it from a consumable model and entice them with the opportunity to buy a non-sustainable option that's cheaper than the sustainable option. And I think this has been, I mean, this has been like capitalism's issue for the last, like, well, since the existence of capitalism, right? We, you know, we've always tried to find the cheapest way to make stuff so that the people who are making it can make more money. And, you know, it's, I think we've come to a point now where we have realized, you know, more must be done and more must be done sooner. I mean, like, even on the note of, you know, in 20, I think it's 2030 or is it 2040 when the production of diesel and petrol cars will come to an end and everything will be moving in an electric direction. It's like a screaming sign of the times of, you know, where we are as a society and how it would just be better for for companies to be ahead of the curve. You don't want to have to be in a position where when you are, you know, forced to make changes, you either A, can't afford it, or B, you know, everybody else has beaten you to it. So it kind of, it says way more about you. You know, I mean, like, I think recently with everything that's happening with Black Lives Matter as well, the national kind of decisions in during the pandemic is showing that, you know, action is way more important than just saying, you know, you'll do better next time kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing stems into the coffee industry, from everything from sourcing to actually selling your coffee. Is, you know, it's better to actually start doing better than just highlighting what the issues are.
Yeah.
This is why I'm sort of praising Raw Material at the moment for their efforts that they're doing with, you know, development firstly in countries like Timor-Leste. And then on top of that is their work that they've done now with the Rwandan landslides.
Mm.
It's something I'm going to read more into this afternoon. Because it's literally happened like a few days ago.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a bit of a scary time for the place, the world at the moment.
Yeah. Sorry. So basically, I've been thinking of this. Like, we live in such a generation where a lot of things just going on right now. It's just like, it's never been like this before. I don't have a thing. So.
Yeah. No. It's. I think right now it's definitely been like, well, everyone's under a magnifying glass, and I think. You know, it's up to this generation, and it's up to you know, our actions to change the course of what could be a really miserable looking future.
Yeah.
I was talking to the farmers who are currently being featured on Voices of Coffee, and I think, you know, what I was hearing from them was a really unfiltered account of their experiences with green bars, for example. And, you know, even that was like a really good look into the sustainability model that some green bars in particular, and I'm not going to name any, but some green bars, you know, do talk about particular sustainable sourcing methods. They just aren't the case. And I think, you know, being able to use that as a sales point is absolutely, you know, despicable to not actually follow through with some of the things that they're saying. So I think you know, the resilience that this generation is showing and the support that we are, you know, starting to get from other generations, you know, before us, is a real you know, it's really telling that we are resilient enough to see this all through. And we are, you know, I think everything, so long as people truly keep to what they're saying they want to do and actually do the things they say they are going to do, you know, we will be able to achieve really, really good things in the coffee industry and in, you know, in the wider society.
It's like the definition of direct trade, which is just something that's passed around almost so freely now. As in, it's just a industry standard to put direct trade on any label, but no one really knows what it means anymore. This was again another James Hoffman point. That guy's everywhere. But working with producers, I think, is a really important step. You know, directly with them, like for example, Kiss a Hippo with Mauricio Chatard. Because that's a way that you can get the boundary of coffee can start being pushed again. You know, it's why we're seeing, I guess, better and better coffee each year. It's no better time to be drinking coffee than right now.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And yeah, I mean, like the conversation I was having with Juan and Kelly during the Voices of Profit their live stream the other day was, you know, is very much centered around the idea that, you know, like on the note of direct trade, is that, you know, a lot of people have a misunderstanding as to what direct trade genuinely is. And, you know, I know when I first kind of dipped my toes in the buying of green coffee, the first piece of information came from somebody else in the industry who said, you know, direct trade is a great way to get really good coffee at a really cheap price. And as my first kind of confrontation with that, as the idea of direct trade, I thought, that doesn't sound good. That doesn't sound like how we sell it as. You know, we sell this as, you know, we are working directly with these people to you know, to better our offering, and, you know, we can keep an eye on how things are traded and to ensure that things are fair, and, you know, we are putting the money directly in their hands. And I think that, you know, that this isn't just like this isn't just a one-off experience that's happened to me. This is the experiences that farmers and producers and people that own estates see on a daily basis. They see people just trying to mug them over, and I think it's a reality. And something that I've started buying from Say recently, SEY, something that I'm sure there are roasters in the UK. I don't know too many other roasters that are doing this, but they post, whenever you buy a coffee from them, you get like an info card and it tells you, you know, information about the coffee. You flip it over and it gives you how much they paid for their freight on board. They tell you how much margin they made from this coffee by selling it to you and what they're doing with that margin. And this is something that Falcon Coffee also do really well. If you can ask, anyone at Falcon when you're buying coffee from them, you know, how much did you pay for this? And they will tell you, like, it's not a secret. They will tell you what they paid. And not enough green traders are doing this. And this is, I think these are the people that Juan and Kelly were telling me about. You know, there's a lot of bad eggs in the industry that will use direct trade as an opportunity to sell coffee, you know, with the pretense that it is possibly doing better than non-directly purchased coffee. Actually it's simply a marketing like a marketing technique. But yeah, I don't know, I think direct trade is such, I mean, you, I think direct trade is that term that hasn't got a definition. So it's hard, like, you hear direct trade and you only want to experience a good association with direct trade. You hear those words and it feels good. It feels like, oh, they've got a relationship with the farm. That's great. But, you know, who knows, really? So yeah.
It's the same with Carl. Carl, basically, our green coffee importer from Brazil, he's just updated his website just literally a day ago. And he just stated all the price they sell to all the coffee roasters around UK.
Yeah.
So, you know, those kind of information make it what we determine as fair trade, you know, fairly trade, break down the cost that's going to the farmer. Same with what I discussed with my boss recently is, you know, don't talk about the coffee price at the UK. Discuss it at the farm. What does the farmer get?
Yeah.
If it's $6 here and going over to Thailand, it's like £3, and it's not really worth it. So let's talk, like, be real. This coffee is great, so I'm going to pay a little bit more than the actual price they're paying UK.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And Emma Haynes, who has been my AST for the last couple of years, and is a really good friend of mine, she said something really that really resonated with me the other day. She said, you know, she wouldn't go into a coffee shop and tell the barista how much she thinks their espresso is worth. She will, you know, you go to a coffee shop in London, you're paying £2.10 or £2.50 for that espresso, whether or not it was good or not. You know, that's what you're paying. And I think the movement that we're going to start seeing, and rightly so, is producers pricing their own coffee and saying, you know, if you want our coffee, this is what you're paying.
Yeah.
If you don't want it, that's fine, because there are so many people that will buy it. And I think too long have producers been totally taken advantage of. I think, you know, something I was talking to again Juan and Kelly about was ASTs and Q graders abusing their status as an opportunity to say, actually, no, your coffee isn't worth as much because we only gave it an 84. It's like, well, that's subjective. So, you know, it cost us this much to make it. So this is how much.
Why don't we just let the roaster make that decision themselves and go to the farmer, I think this is my coffee and this is what it's worth. If you want something a little bit lower, this is what I have for you.
Yeah, exactly. And it's giving the producer the ownership of their coffee and not dictating to them how much you're going to buy it for. You might go onto a farm and onto a cupping table with a particular budget in mind. Mm. But if that coffee exceeds your budget, if you really want it, you'll buy that coffee. I think that's another part of the, you know, the direct trade kind of mythology that we're still trying to break down.
But yeah, that's very cool. So basically, you know, we're going to talk about a little bit about your roasting philosophy. You know, what's your thoughts? So maybe just like try to make a scenario of like you actually sourcing coffee. So let's just say you're sourcing for Costa Rica coffee. Yeah.
Right. The kind of philosophy that I've been following over the last few years is really, I'm a big believer in omni-roasting coffee being the most enjoyable for the mass of customers. So if you are buying, let's say, Costa Rican honeyed, you want to do everything you can to really amplify the sweetness and amplify the crisp acidity. And ensure that no matter how they're brewing it, if they're brewing it as an espresso, if they're brewing it as a filter, it will be enjoyed by all of the people that bring it. So, you know, the philosophy that I've really been following as closely as I can, and this is, you know, I'm constantly learning. If it's articles written by Christopher Ferrin or articles written by Scott Rayo, you know, it's looking at as much data as I can. And I think from a roasting, especially from a profiling perspective, you know, your profile is only going to be as consistent as the data that you record. And, you know, the more you roast, the more data you record, the more you learn. I've kind of, over the course of, you know, 5 years I've been roasting, I've realized what certain coffees look like at certain batch sizes. And I've used, you know, a plethora of different roasting machines. I've come to learn what a cast iron roaster will tend to look like on Cropster versus what a stainless steel roaster will come to look like on Cropster. And if I'm trying to replicate the same thing, it's quite difficult if it's almost like a fluid bed roaster to a kind of flatbed roaster. My philosophy is based purely on data and on you know, ensuring that the customers are going to enjoy you know, every single cup as much as they can. And it's literally just amplifying the you know, the potentials in every single cup. You know, something that I've noticed is you can be roasting one coffee that you think is, you know, possibly the best you can get out of it until you try something different. You know, maybe it's towards the end of the roast, maybe you're trying to extend the mild reaction, or maybe you want to give it a lower turning point. You know, all of these things can change your coffee in really dramatic ways, even if it's just a really, like a really minute, really small change. this will and likely have a an effect, positive or negative, on your coffee. So these kind of changes will have a total impact on the way that, on the flavor profile of your coffee. So I think my philosophy is literally just using all the data that I have and to try and keep consistency in it. I think it's okay to change a profile on a roast if you think you can get something better out of it, and if you can't, that's not a problem. Just record that as data. Keep the data coming, basically.
Shall we start with the question from people?
Yeah.
Right, okay, I've got it. What is so far the best coffee that you've ever roasted? And why is it at the top of your list?
I think the Udaini from Yemen, which is what Rodolfo used in the UKBCs this year. I think it's probably the top of my list because it's such a different variety to any coffee I've experienced. It presented an incredibly different flavor profile to any coffee I've ever experienced, and coupling that with the amazing work that Kima Coffee are doing in Yemen, I think that with the incredible club score we got from it, I think that definitely took the top mark. I'd love to take credit for the Shatar rice, but that was Josh Arley's rice, so I can't take too much credit there.
One of the things, I've tried this coffee, by the way, the Yemeni.
Yeah.
And when I think this was before the roast profile had been finalized, because it was at May's Cupping in Fitzrovia. And just, I could tell which bowl was going to be good because Josh Tarlow just kind of stood over it and was just kind of with this ladle, just scooping out and slurping and retasting and coming back to it. It was always the same bowl. And I was like, this was when it was all blind, there were no cards or anything to tell you what was what. And then when we found out that, yes, this was the Yemeni coffee, and I spoke to him afterwards and said, I think the Yemen's amazing, it's a really nice coffee. And he was like, oh yeah. And just the way that he was then talking about the process behind it and the sourcing and why he was so excited about it, he was like, it's the closest window that you've got to the oldest coffee in the world, how coffee originally tasted, because it was from, correct me if I'm wrong, because this is, I'm just remembering this, he was like, it was from an old variety of trees that were originally in Ethiopia that were then taken to Yemen through one method or another, I can't really remember, but then the original trees had died from leaf rust.
Right. I think my understanding isn't as detailed in history as that, but I do know that that particular variety of coffee dates as far back to, I think it was the 1300s or something, super early. This is borderline the beginning of international coffee trade. And I think to have experienced a coffee that has so much history to it. I mean, actually, looking at the green beans themselves, they look vintage, they look super old. And it was, I don't know, it was incredible. I mean, I love backpack coffee. I can't get enough of it. The first moment you rip into a backpack, you get kind of that burst of air coming out. Doing that to a coffee that actually looked like it was like a general, it's almost like it had been left in a backpack time capsule for the last 700 years. And it just, I don't know, it was such a bizarre coffee to roast. It was incredible. I felt like I was roasting for the first time. It was proper, excitement around it. We were watching this on crops, and I was like, oh, I've never seen coffee behave like this before. it's when you first, I don't know if you've roasted a Pacamara or a Margarita or something like that, you're expecting something different. And this exceeded my expectations of different coffee. I think that also goes to, it goes to show in the cup that it tasted completely different to if you were to compare it to you know, like a high score in Ethiopian coffee. You know, you can expect very floral, very kind of strawberry, blueberry kind of notes from the Ethiopian. But this didn't offer that. This offered something that was it was closer to wine than it was coffee.
It was a really
interesting experience. I was over the moon when Rodolfo was going to be using this for his UKBCs, and I was absolutely amazed I was going to be roasting this for Rodolfo's entry. And you know, I'm so proud that he got as far as he did. First time competing and he made the final. It was absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
And to put Yemeni coffee on the center of the UKBC stage was just it was an amazing feeling, amazing amount of personal pride, and amazing just knowing that Kima were getting a shout out on the biggest stage in the UK coffee industry. So yeah.
That's amazing.
Got some incredible coffees coming out over really more noticeably the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. It's what Kima have done, and they've done it so well, is every year bring out a better coffee and a better coffee and a better coffee from Yemen. Especially given all of the associations with Yemen, that the rest of the world don't get to experience in person, but we only get to see it from our TV screens and everything back here in the UK or from the rest of the world. It was a real highlight to the beauty that exists in Yemen, and to the amount of care and attention that each of the farmers and producers would have been putting into ensuring that all of their nano lots were so well looked after and so well cultivated. Huge shout out to Kima. That was an incredible find.
Oh, gosh, gotcha.
The work that they're doing is just fantastic. So, yeah.
So, talk to me about your approach to that coffee then, on your roasting.
Having a nightmare
the night before you roasting it.
Well, when it arrived, it came in. I wish I brought some. I've kept one. It's in the roastery. It came in the most fantastic looking box that was was sealed with a magnet. So you lift it up and you get this kind of a nice heavy and a really weighted lid. So it just felt nice to open. And then it's got kind of the tawar around it, and you can see the altitude. And it's all measured. It just looked fantastic. And then you open it up and you've got this, they came in 5 kilo, I think it's 5 kilo.
Yeah, five kilo.
5 kilo bags, backpacked bags. And I can remember when I opened it for the first time, I actually felt something like, oh my God, this is, who am I? Why am I even here right now? I hadn't tasted this coffee before we roasted it. So my only expectation, I know obviously Josh has got incredible sourcing tactics and techniques, and the coffee that he finds, we all know they're all kind of bang. So I was very excited to try this. I was a little bit nervous. Well, no, I was incredibly nervous because I just started. So it was by the way, the first coffee you're going to roast is from Yemen, so good luck. that was very nerve-wracking. But also, having not tasted this coffee before, I was very anxious that I knew how much we were paying for this. It was an incredibly expensive coffee. Knowing that, we are expecting this to score at least 92 was, for my first roast on a luring machine as well, was just
whole different thing.
So I don't know, the approach to the Yemeni coffee was, it was 2300 mafsal, so I knew it was going to be a high altitude color. My kind of starting point was, let's compare this to an Ethiopian. As my point of reference, is probably going to require the same amount of attention that you would roast a high altitude Ethiopian. So I'm going to be looking for acidity. I'm going to be looking for florality, possibly a lot of sweetness. We want to mimic this, but using 5 kilos at a time, it's really hard to sell 5 kilos of Yemeni coffee in a week. These are small batches on a third of the capacity of our So, you know, your roasting, your drop-in temps are pretty low, and the changes that you're making during the roast are incredibly minute. So it kind of, although it ensures that you're not going to be going really above 60 or 70% of the burning capacity, but you are going, you know that every percentile change is going to make a huge difference. I think the first test roast, which I think the one you were referring to, Ben, was like our gauge. It was like, so this is what the first production roast test, like, let's see where we can go from there and how we can adapt. We're really lucky and we're really fortunate to have that coffee until March. So it's like 3 months of constantly exploring and learning more about Yemeni coffee. And I'm sure Yemen's going to be an origin we buy from year on, year out. It was really good.
Yeah. I was going to ask a question. There's a lot of questions that's been answered during the podcast anyway.
So. Okay.
No, I was just going to say, Nat, when can I try your roast of it?
Roast of what?
The Yemen.
Yemen, oh God, £25 a kilo to start. No. Don't know. Maybe on my own project and introducing Yemeni coffee.
I'm just looking. Yeah, we basically have answered every question.
Yeah.
I guess the only thing we really add, the only one is from Josh Traffin.
Yeah.
Which is, let me just read it, is what copies are you, Kiss the Hippo, looking to buy post COVID-19, or are we not allowed to know?
I'm really excited. So I've been working with, so producers that I've been working with prior to working at Kiss the Hippo, I'm now kind of putting in touch with Josh, and we're trying samples all the time. So I think some of the coffees are going to be coffees that I'm very familiar with. Some of the producers that I've been working with over the last few years. We haven't necessarily mapped out what our next catalogue is going to look like. We are actually in the process of we're going through the last of what we have on our website right now. So we are due for a revamp in the next couple of weeks. We are definitely coming to the end of things like our Sholi, which is going to be gutting to see go. Our Los Naranjos, I know we've only got a few roasts of that left. So if you're a fan of a nice busy Colombian, then the Los Naranjos, you got a couple of weeks left of that one. In the future, it's still very much we're still very much sourcing. So
have you still got the Lajas?
We do, yeah. I think I've got a couple of bags of that left actually. So we're also going to be pushing this one into our stay home care package for the NHS. So we're going to try and get the Lajas out to more and more people that wouldn't necessarily go for a Peruvian. I've personally found, and I know that a lot of our customers and our staff as well, like, also find that the Lajas is an incredible kind of.
Yeah, we really enjoyed it here as well.
Yeah, it's a really unique. I find that it's a really unique example of just how good Peruvian coffee can be.
Oh yeah.
A couple of years ago, I think it finished like 28th or something in the Cup of Excellence from Peru, and I managed to get a couple of boxes of it. And the Lajas tastes like equally as good as this coffee that. So I wouldn't be surprised to see Lajas in the Cup of Excellence over the next coming years, because I just think it is an exceptional coffee. Really, really, really happy with that one.
So I highlighted as well my personal question in red and bold. Huh?
And you nearly missed it.
Yeah, I nearly missed it. I just look at the bottom and I'm just like, what's the thing? Why is it red? So I was going to ask you, what is the highlight of your career as a coffee roaster so far?
Oh, wow. I think the highlight for me has been kind of exploring something. I think actually it might have been my breakaway from the kind of conventional... because I think it's a path I could have followed. So I was looking into pre getting into coffee. I was looking to go to teaching, And it was you know, I did a year long kind of teaching. It was like part of my university course, and it was like a kind of a teacher placement when I was working in a secondary school in northwest London. And I loved every minute of it, but I felt as if that my passion for music and my passion for kind of film studies was just starting to dwindle a little bit. I think it's because I was coming closer and closer to the end of my degree. Yeah. And I was feeling more and more nervous about you know, the real working world and being a proper adult. But I think, you know, falling into coffee roasting changed my career, and I think it gave me an opportunity to actually explore something that it's weird. It's a weird job, right? Because you love every part of it. Like I can't. There's not a part of my job I don't like.
You
get to try. I mean, you know, you get to try coffee after coffee. You get to be in a position, you know, especially when you're in a buying position, where you can, you know, what you're doing and the impact you can have on so many different people. Is huge, and I think it fills me with a massive amount of pride. The people you get to meet, the coffee community is incredible. So, you know, being able to be a part of that and to meet new people, to learn from so many other roasters, so many other brewers, baristas, everything. You know, the whole theme is just, you know, exactly kind of where I feel like I wanted to be the entire time I was at uni looking to become a teacher. So. I think that was probably the highlight of my career so far, is going into roasting in the first place and kind of breaking away from where I thought I was going to be going, and, you know, moving into something that was just so much more enjoyable and, you know, so much more warming. So yeah, I think that's probably it.
Amazing, man. Looking forward to have you as long as we can. But yeah, I think that's everything. So thank you so much, Marcus, for your time.
No, thank you for having me.
Time.
Thank you so much, you guys, for joining in. And it's been a very good episode. And looking forward to have some more. Maybe part two. We were great. Oh,
absolutely, part two. Yeah. Like uncharted territory that we still need.
No, it will have to be part two because we're going to do that experiment together.
And one final quick reminder that we do have a giveaway currently with Niche. So if you do want to win a grinder and some coffee and some brewing equipment, the best place to go is to Niche Coffee and enter the giveaway there. You can enter as many times as you like. Just tag a friend in the comments, and it's on until the 19th of June.